Good evening. Welcome to this evening's event in the newly dubbed Language Arts Live Reading Series, brought to you by the Department of English, the Program in Environmental Studies, the Mellon Foundation Grants, and the John Taliabue Poetry Fund. Tonight, it is my great pleasure to introduce poet Jeffrey Thompson, who's come down from the silent, snowy fields of Farmington, Maine, where he is Associate Professor of Creative Writing in the BFA program, to share his extraordinary work with us. Jeff is the author of four books of poems, including the new collection Bird Watching in Wartime, which just came out from Carnegie Mellon, and Renovation, also from Carnegie Mellon in 2005, both of which, as well as copies, I believe, of his previous book, are available for sale and signing after the reading. Also forthcoming is an anthology of emerging poets, From the Fish House, an anthology of poems that sing, rhyme, resound, syncopate, alliterate, and just plain sound great. An anthology that's co-edited with Camille Dungy and Matt O'Donnell. Matt's with us tonight. He's recording this reading for The Fish House. And that's a book that you definitely will want to look into. It's going to come with a CD as well, yes? So one will be able to listen to these poems. And I urge you to visit the website as well at your leisure. So, Jeff has won fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Pennsylvania Arts Commission, and most recently, he was named the 2008 Individual Fellow in the Literary Arts by the Maine Arts Commission. Like Elizabeth Bishop, the master to whom he makes an affectionately ironic bow in the first poem of Bird Watching in Wartime, Jeffrey Thompson turns the virtue of being observant into a visionary gift. The poems in his new book bring the exotic into intimate, intense, impinging focus, while raising the ordinary quotidian experience of desire, grief, and curiosity into their deservedly mysterious haunts. Out of long sentences and subtly orchestrated lines that build and accumulate force not merely rhetorical, but more nearly gravitational, Jeff makes poems that manage to both surprise and arrive at destinations that seem satisfyingly inevitable. These poems, as Betsy Shaw has aptly written, take us to the places where, quote, what we can and cannot know seem to engender each other. I'm very pleased that Jeff has joined us to put these poems on the air tonight, so will you please welcome Jeffrey Thompson.
All right, so as tonight we begin with this week's episode, we find our intrepid hero, that would be me, deep in the heart of the Amazon rainforest, about to be stung by a whole hive full of wasps. So this poem is called Landscape with Swelling and Hives. When the siloam swam from the deadfall across the path, a moss-grown nurse log hosting a thrumming mess of life in its rain-woven campus, when those wasps stapled my back and sides and face and sent me at a run down the piebald path. When the rainforest trembled, fishtail palms kicking their fins in the green welter beneath the canopy. When the splotches flushed across my arms, my neck, my sweat-licked face. When the diaspora of venom wrote a question across my back in hot letters that left me cold and shaking and desperately needing to piss. I had no sense. Stunned and numb that my throat might close, not even when my tongue went dumb and swelled like a river fat with flood. No thought that the last sight I'd see would be a green shriek of light carried through the trees. The wasps stung for nothing I had done. The others had passed that path before me, the chill washed out in sweat and the landscape tumbled back to form. But hours out, perhaps I should have made my peace, prepared myself among the Pichirina and the Pukahuasca, and waited for the infinite to break through the canopy in a spray of green gone gold. In the end, nothing came of this. My throat stayed open and the canopy closed. It's the distance out from camp, the gas lamps lit and tented in the shifting dark, the house macaw patrolling the peered walkways, little chevrons flashing on his shoulders, that makes it menacing. Yes, it would have been a pity not to have seen the spattered sun scribbled down to nothing more than matchlight on army ants engraving leaf litter, the cuneiform of taper prints in the mud of that flat-banked stream, not to have seen the wattle jacana scrawl across water lilies with his vast forked feet. A pity never to have taken piranha from the river and watched them slap their gibberish across the bottom of the boat. Yes, a pity never to have read the remains of a saddleback tamarin, a slur of fur and black fingers as the fact of a jaguar in the night. Yes, a pity, yes. But what now's the answer to that question, written across my skin? I want to thank Rob for bringing me to Bates. This is a real pleasure to read for you guys. I want to thank Matt, my co-editor of the anthology, and the director and inventor of the Fish House, which is a phenomenal website if you don't know about it, www.fishhousepoems.org. You should go check it out. It's got the best contemporary poets up there reading their poems for you to listen to and talking about their craft. For broadcasting this, we're going to do this as a podcast, so you should look for that. I want to thank you all for coming out on this night, and I want to just enjoy this space and listening to poetry. That last poem was the poem that Rob spoke about, the poem that begins with an Elizabeth, sort of a nod to Elizabeth Bishop. And like Elizabeth Bishop, her poems, a lot of her poems take the book poems in this book take place in the rainforests of Costa Rica and Peru, in the neotropics. But this next one takes place in Thailand. And I was watching this special on PBS about the working elephants in Bangkok, and this strange quote came over the airwaves. It said, "Nobody knows exactly how many elephants there are in Bangkok." And I said, "Well, I mean, they're elephants, right? I mean, one, two, three. You know, I mean, they're not cockroaches. They're not mosquitoes. You could count them, but apparently there's so many elephants. So here we are. This is called Landscape with Urban Elephants." Up from the dumps and the red hollows, where water wells from bottle-speckled mud. Up from the scrub and cracked palms. Up from the can fires into the dazzle and slither of traffic muscling around these boulders of hide and wattle. Up from a distant bliss of tree fern and orchid. From mahogany and kapok, the elephants come to the city. Big-shouldered and waddled, their slow bop strut up the boulevard, a repertoire of rolled eights, kept by the metronome of bottle-brush tails, syncopated by reflecting tape patched across their asses. Painting elephants, dancing elephants, peanut-eating, banana-slinging elephants, half-smiles and great gray Walt Whitman eyes, above the bike lights that swing from their trunks. Traffic swerves around their oil-thick piles of shit. Beneath it all, a squall of noise, a flutter of trunks. They sing platterfoot, big toe, skin of wet burlap. They sing, "It don't mean a thing if you ain't got that swing." Deep into the night, alight with sodium, their backbeat rumbles travel for miles, pacing a hi-hat rhythm the tuk-tuks keep beneath the skytrain. They totter it off to sleep it off beneath the milk-colored dawn as their tails keep their own rough time. So at the center of this book being Birdwatching in Wartime, the new one, is this long sectional poem based on a piece of writing by Jorge Luis Borges. And Borges was writing in an essay called The Analytical Language of John Wilkins. John Wilkins was an English theologian, philosopher, who was trying to come up with a perfect language, right? A language in which there would be no slippage between the sign and the signifier, between the word and what it means, what it represents in the world. And being very, very wise and sort of an early postmodernist, Borges recognizes this is the way we do, as being sort of impossible and silly at the same time. So in an impossible and silly kind of way to make fun of it, instead of saying, "Oh, that's kind of stupid," right? He says, he makes up this ancient Chinese encyclopedia called the Celestial Emporium of Benevolent Knowledge. And in the Celestial Emporium of Benevolent Knowledge, all plants and animals can be divided into certain categories, like those that belong to the emperor, those that have just broken a flower vase, those that look like flies from a distance. And so these wonderful imaginative categories, right? And so what I've done is I've written a poem for each of these sections. I'm going to read you just a few of these. This one is "Those Drawn with a Very Fine Camel's Hair Brush." when I got to this one, I didn't know what a camel's hair brush was, so I had to look it up. That's sort of where we begin. It's not what I thought, not gamey mohair shaved from the gamey flank. And Mr. Camel, the inventor, not named for the hair lip, for the split toes, for the god-awful smell and the knees swollen as breadfruit. Not Atta Allah, God's gift with its boat-rolling gait, not the ropey tail. Rather, it's the ox or the goat, squirrel or pony, carcasses abandoned for the delicacy of a caress, remains as in affirmation, as in a man stroking the cheekbones of his telescope's mirror up on the high balcony, the city painted around him like the caves at Lascaux, tinted bulls in ochre and carmine, the bird-headed man scorched in cinnamon, and the swimming stags. True stars extinct in the city, the night sky gone the color of sun-baked asphalt, a welter of traffic rivering beneath his feet. He watches a man and a woman undress each other down the barrel of Third Avenue, their several shadows burned onto the wall, as with the delicacy of a camel's hair brush. This one is called Those That Are Trained. The dog behind the fence is a symbol for desire, for the anywhere but here grit on the teeth found up the endless swerve of river road high at the end of the valley. The bent paneling, creased as tar in the den, where the blue suede from the small black and white fills the room, and the only station on this slate is a gospel station, where a preacher mutters and sweats and then gut punches a man whose cancer has returned. The paneling says something, too, about desire, as the room goes gravel-colored with smoke, the remains of a dime bag on a black album striped by the full spectrum. But leave them now, these two boys who might be you and me, these two boys who have the TV sound turned down and Dark Side cranked again, and the alarms are detonating, and the bells, and the clock tick-tocks like a damaged heart, and it all seems at once easy and impossible, because the road down valley is the only road to everywhere, as the dog barks and barks and will never, ever shut the fuck up. It's okay to laugh, really. I won't be offended. It won't break the poetry spell, right? You know, sometimes you figure people get worried. Oh, should I laugh at that? I don't know. Is that funny? I don't know. I don't want to offend him. So this is another one, hopefully, that you'll laugh at a little bit. It's called Fabulous Ones, and it features somebody that you all know, Big Bird. And it is also brought to you by the letter C, just for clarification, right? Cattle egret, Big Bird says. Cetacean. The word squeaking like wet whale skin. Big Bird keeps it real, his thug life strut. Do you like giants? Only the small ones, the boy says. Chinese catfish, cassava, cassowary. He's an intellectual, spends his days off in coffee houses, crossing and uncrossing the long orange tubes of his legs, discussing Chomsky, conditional freedom, and Cervantes with anyone who will listen. He marches against the war, 1,000 people at his back, chanting catastrophe, cruise missile, children. Big Bird refuses to fly south for the winter, puts on his scarf, and heads out the door. I know Big Bird's not real, the boy says. It's just a suit with a little bird inside. This is called Those That Tremble As If They Were Mad. And you sort of have to remember the title of this sequence, which is The Celestial Emporium of Benevolent Knowledge, right? Because that sort of starts to play into this one. It takes place in a valley high up in the mountains in Costa Rica called the Sauvagre River Valley, which is a very beautiful place, tons of hummingbirds flying around. It's a cloud forest valley. Sunlight slits into the mist, which lingers in the forest, leaves so jittery with the pulse of dripping water, their shadows tremble on the forest floor. And a hummingbird, a green-violet ear, haunts the lilac-blazed path down the Sauvagre Valley, where in stock ponds, trout rib the water with interlocking loops as they rise toward a late hatch of stonefly. The bird's incomprehensible heart hammers up into the rafters of its chest as its black tongue wires the blossoms from below. And what this has to do with knowledge, who can say? Madness could be the road down canyon. Laddered switchbacks testing the gearbox could be coffee plantations woven into the cliffside, the crimson pointillisme of the fruit against the waxy leaves. But benevolence must be the oceanic color of the tear that streaks the emerald iridescence, must be the act of naming this bird for the sea, Colibri thalassinus. Far from the shore, the cloud surf breaks against the coast of the Cordillera, far below. This is innumerable ones. How to count? Begin with 1 or n plus 1, where n is the number of ants in a colony, and 1 is you looking over your own shoulder, looking into the earth, driving a stick down into the mound like a gifted chimp, pulling it out to count the inscrutable bodies, huge-headed warriors sawing the wood. Where n is bacteria, and 1 is your colon, the wealth of E. coli colonizing and shifting up river, where N is the burger you ate yesterday, and 1 is you heaving into the sink and falling back, racked with fever. Where N is brine shrimp, and 1 the stink they make on a hot day, the light above the Great Salt Lake gone flat and gauzy. Where N is caribou cresting across the porcupine in the Yukon, and N squared, the mosquitoes that blind them, eyes jammy with crushed bodies and drive them mad. Where 1 is the Cessna and the rifle, where 1 is the bullet and the carcass resting on the tundra's mossy sponge. And then just one more of these, and we'll move on to something.
Some other types of things.
This is those that have just broken a flower vase. Can you imagine having to write a poem for that? I mean, seriously, it's like, what the hell do I do with that? And so it took me a long time to find the poem. That's what it kind of became, this thing, is this effort to find the poem in the title. Because some birds land only to nest, because they travel through the canyon's half-light like science fiction standards, the swerve and veer through a dangerous chute, because down valley, the landscape fades to a geometric test of wills, algebraic agriculture arguing with the river's floodplain calculus, because the clouds branch and froth in blossom above the Allegheny Mountains, because these peaks have been lifted up and torn down 3 times, because exhaustion writes its name in deer trails across smoky hillsides in midwinter, because beauty walks hand in hand with grief, because it's the only time she'll ever see one, I'll talk about the collared swift that died in flight and landed in my neighbor's Pachysandra. The picture window rang where it smacked the glass. Framed in the casement, her husband drops to his knees in the March-wet earth, a stroke blooming up the branches in his head. At least, that is how I choose to imagine it. The gelling of the narrative around the low tone of rung glass, the warm carcass of the bird splayed in the elegant green of the new shoots, his dead arm slump as the cat, startled, drops from the pie chest and knocks a bud vase from its place. So, as she turns to find the door, she sees them both there, suspended in midair, with all the grace of everything about to shatter. This one is called Underwhelmed. Under the catastrophic dark, the comet splintering the sky with its ancient grief, under the splay-handed palms, under drinks glowering dark in globes of glass, under the tender humidity, the phosphorescent surf, under the calls of nightjars chuckling up from the ground, under the ticking aloe, under the moon's absence, under, 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 under the blinking stripes, jets right across the sky, under stillness, the cabin pressure holding steady, under the coned light, blanking out pages of gloss, under the plunge of my love's hair, her eyes startling as stars, under our lives, the miscarried child left in the bowl, underground, underwater, under story. Under the bougainvillea's whorish musk, under the coral's forest of horn, under God, under toe, under dog, under everything there is a season, under the absence of twilight, under the beach's griddle and bone, under the words startle, startle, under the luxury of the table so whitely laid, under the candle's light shaped like a hanging blade, we tear apart the body of the fish and leave glistening ladders of bone. This is a highly educated crowd, right? Absolutely. So I'm going to read you a poem about Bugs Bunny. This is called Ars Poetica with Pain, And it actually starts with an episode of Bugs Bunny that I'd never seen. And then Orpheus and Eurydice come in. You guys know what an Ars Poetic is, yeah? It's a poem, literally means the art of poetry, right? So it's a poem about poetry. So, and you guys know the Orpheus and Eurydice myth, right? Yes? No? Okay. Orpheus and Eurydice is sort of the founding myth of poetry, right? It's a Greek myth. Orpheus and Eurydice were a young couple. Orpheus was a poet. Eurydice was his wife. On the day of their marriage, Eurydice was stung by a serpent in her heel and was killed and descended into Hades. And Orpheus was inconsolable. And so he followed her down, and he played a song for on his lyre. That's how poets sang back then. And he played a song for Hades and Persephone, and all hell stopped. It's the only time hell ever stopped working. So the machinery of hell stopped. And Sisyphus stopped pushing his boulder up, you know. Tantalus stopped reaching for the water or the fruit. And everybody, all the ghosts were weeping at his song. And so, except for the queen, Persephone. And so they allowed Orpheus to take Eurydice out of hell on the condition that he not look at her. And so they climb the stairs to hell, and they almost get out, and at the threshold, he turns a little too early and sees her, and she disappears and dies a second time. And Orpheus is inconsolable again, but he's not allowed back into hell this time. Nothing he can do will allow him into hell, and he sings his songs of despair to the trees. And in this grove, all the trees gather around him in sympathy. And he refuses the love of all women and takes up with boys. This is what Ovid says. And there's this group of women, these Bacchantes, these Thracian women, who are followers of Dionysus, that are particularly enraged that he's spurning the love of all women. So they charge at him in a group, screaming madly, and tear him apart, physically rip him apart, and his head floats down the river singing. Right? So this is the story of poetry, okay? And at so many levels, it's the story of poetry. So this one is called Ars Poetica with Pain. And so you'll begin to understand why. So, I mean, you see the myth, and all of you know Bugs Bunny, so you won't need any explanation with that. In this one, Yosemite Sam gets hung. Bugs digs his way into the prison yard after he'd missed that mythical left at Albuquerque, and soon Sam's big hat flaps in the wind, his knee-high shit-kickers jerking in midair. It's not Eurydice stumbling into ecstasy up the moss-tumbled steps, Orpheus erect before her. It's not Bugs smacking carrots as the fade circles down around him and the cursive loops across the screen, Kraft and the hero victorious in the common tongue. All the strange grammars of success yield the elastic cat who balloons back to wholeness after being smacked with the frying pan, or the duck that slips his bill back across his jaw after eating a load of buckshot. Never the scene when Elmer Fudd blotches his crotch with piss as Bugs readies to take his kneecaps with his own shotgun. In this one, Eurydice chews on a worm of pain that sounds like farewell to Orpheus, untuned to the choral music of hell, and Orpheus's head, cast aside, floats forever singing. In this one, the Thracian women toss the broken lyre, mangled as a smashed racket, into the fire, as smoke ropes up around their throats, and the strings hiss and curl into ampersands. So that poem is an attempt to figure out why I write poems like this next one, which is about Stalin. This is a true story about Stalin. It's called Stalin on Stage. The angelic gilt of the ceiling lit with stage light imitation, fractured surf of the gold leaf pouring across the proscenium, the aging rafters, the crowd speckled with reflection. All this brings us to Stalin. Stalin on stage. To the moment when he has just finished speaking and the audience rises in unison to collapse the air with their applause. Minutes pass, and no one will stop, the very air threatened by the noise, until one general, a veteran of wars in Tannenberg, an armada of ribbons blockading the Baltic of his uniform, drops his hands and sits. We know the history, so we know the story now, before it's given, how he is rousted and pummeled at dawn, the trees in the cold grove gather round him as the rifles rise, Never be the first to stop applauding Stalin, he is told, before the gun's ovation rises into the glacial sky, bird call returning after a brief silence. This is wrong as I return to the source to reread the history, the general just an owner, his paper factory offering up the forms that will be filled out to detail the reams of his misfortune. He wasn't killed, wasn't turned out into the morning trees and introduced to the mouths of 20 weapons. He was given 10 years in the gulag, 10 years at labor in the flesh-splitting cold, 10 years in the joy of short sunlight, 10 years. Does that make it better or worse? On his release, his daughter's there to collect him, and they hobble into the flat March light, holding on to each other in the Riga station. The train pulls at them as it leaves, the sound of its wheels on the ties at the crossing like men beating a horse with boards. That train that once carried the poem's moral center vanishes into a cold drizzle that falls on their necks, gilds their hair with dew with the hue of piss, almost the color of the wash of gold above Stalin, who remains, of course, up on stage, beneath the clarion lights and seraphs, his face bright as paper, drenched in the warmth of the applause that somehow never dies. Yeah, that's a happy one, isn't it? So, I'm gonna read it. One from each of these other books. This is from The Country of Lost Sons, which is a book a lot about my son, who is now 10, and him growing up. But this is a poem sort of about, it's called Against Prognostication, and it's a poem thinking about my own childhood, because I was what you might call a difficult child to raise. I don't know, that would be putting it generously, I think. So me trying not to read my own past onto my son's future and failing at it. It's sort of one of these fake-out poems, too, that says it's not going to do these things as it goes ahead and does them. Right, so Against Prognostication. I've not written about my son's future, not yet, how he will read and reread the Ottoman field guide and memorize each bird, how he will wander off under dappled light and return home in a squad car. Not because I can't imagine the way he will carefully hold his hand above his heart after he has unfurled the skin from his meaty thumb, or how he will rip apart a frog, hind legs to jaw, and how he will feel after. I have not talked about the day he will wrap his friend's car around a tree and somehow walk away, leaving the scene limping home to sleep in bloody sheets. Not out of fear, though this genealogy hints at it. This reticence is caution, not reprimand. What can he learn, anyway, from such a history? That day will still come when he opens his palm above a flame and smells himself burning. Perhaps by then his father will be brave enough to let him have his own life. But I will not say be comforted, for comfort comes at a price. And I will not talk about what comes next. A girl, a kiss, a field of grass. His thin heart tearing as she leaves. That part of the story is all anyone wants. Denouement and then the singing. Operatic camera work pulling back to reveal his loneliness in the grass. Blue herons stalking through a salt marsh at sunset. 10 glaucus gulls and a blackback on the gables of the paintworks, riding out the storm. Then one poem from Renovation. This is a poem I wrote. At my last job, I was teaching in a very small school. I teach now in the BFA program up at the University of Maine, Farmington. My last job, I taught at a very small women's college in Pittsburgh, and it was so small that I was asked to go in and review the teaching of one of my colleagues. And that's not the unusual thing about it. The unusual thing about it was that this colleague was in the math department. So, you know, he was a friend of mine, so I think that's why he asked me. So I went in, you know, and, you know, it was like double, triple secret calculus or something. I don't know what it was, right? I go in there and he's, you know, I'm trying to be a good guy. I'm trying to think about how he's teaching rather than what he's actually saying, since I don't understand most of what he's actually saying. And so he gets to this one point when the students are all stumped with his problem, you know, and I'm stumped, you know, and he says, well, we can solve this problem using imaginary numbers. Yeah, I perked up at that, as you might imagine. I didn't know we could do that, you know. It would have made my experience in math a great deal easier, you know. Apparently, though, imaginary number is a quantity I, right? Makes sense. such that I equals the square root of negative 1, or I squared equals negative 1. Right? And even I get that this is sort of like a math professor scam that they're running, right? Because if you square something, if you multiply two negatives, it ought to be positive, right? But apparently this helps them solve insolvable problems, you know, and what, you know, that's cool. I'm fine. Yeah, if that's how you got to do it. You know, I'm fine with making stuff up. Well, but the problem is immediately that I'm writing a poem, because this is the coolest thing I've heard in a long time about math. The other part of the story is that, you know, this just goes to show you should never send poets to do real work, right? Because we're not good at it, right? We should just be left alone to do our own little thing in our little houses. So this is called Imaginary Numbers. As in light coming distances in the humming blankness from stars already shuttered and collapsed, as in the volume of water not in the bottle, the area of the shadow of a missing limb, the way winter light through glass warms nothing, the speed at which on the rain-slick, leaf-scattered Katanning Pike the accident doesn't happen, the car doesn't slew and swing out against the oncoming traffic, horns don't blare, glass doesn't turn to a geometry of pain, and so she returns home after work, with the dusk already clamoring up the house, the porch light out, haphazard mail and the message light flashing down the hall. It could be that her child, gone to stay with his father, has called to say he loves her, or that her husband has left her for another man, a rodeo clown, perhaps, and she won't know whether to be enraged or amused. Or perhaps it's her dentist confirming her appointment as her cats twine between her legs, demanding to be fed. If possibility is the square of experience, what can she say of this day? Its unknown grief haunting the house, painting the walls with its brushwork of headlight and shadow. Outside, the rain begins again and slaps the grass, the bare limbs of the trees scaffolding the exponential dark. She snaps on the light and sees herself repeated in the mirror, at once doubled and inexplicably exhausted. I think I'll read some new, just like three or four new poems, because I always like the new poems best. I'm working on these poems that this new sort of stuff that I'm doing. It's sort of about the form of the poem. It's sort of like me trying to make poems out of stuff that doesn't seem poetic at all when you start off with it. I'm trying to jam sort of poems into other forms and see what I can do with it. So this one takes the form of a series of personal ads in the newspaper. So it's just called Personal. Tall cafe mocha, looking for plain black decaf. Thick-necked man, snores like a sick hog. Seeks deaf woman. Lip reading a plus. Woman who speaks only English needs man who speaks only Spanish. No talking during the movie. Bisexual cowboy, seeks same. Man who distills own vodka from purple fingerling potatoes seeks woman who can drink him under the table. Man who has failed at everything he's tried seeks woman who doesn't know the meaning of failure. Let me teach you. Small brains, small chest, looking for a man with low standards. It's not me saying this. Just like your mother, I'll be disappointed whatever you do. Please call and don't forget to eat. Poet in need of praise, lie to me, please. I pay by the word. All right, so you see how much fun this can be. This one is called, This is a Test of the Emergency Broadcast System. So I think you can guess what form it's in, right? Had this been a true emergency, there would have been the sound of elephants in the falling rubble and bowing girders. There would have been blare and clash, ruckus and mortuary work. There would have been symphonic want and multisyllabic heartbreak, banner headlines and bandwagons. Had this been a true emergency, you would have been directed to breathe in the smoke from the lingering fires of all the speeches that reference this day. There would have been soldiers sent and garrisons, oil and tents, rifles black as snouts, roughing up, electrodes, and hoods. There would have been a man thrown from a helicopter, genuflecting and orchestras, and roundups, yes, and hoodlums rumbling through the streets in vast, gassed-up militias of the night. There would have been the illusion of control, fear of suitcases, a ban on ball bearings, a new architecture based on Kevlar and concrete, and the absence of windows that will not be missed. Had this been a true emergency, there would have been caskets and a run on flags, sniggering and something about a zoo, razor wire and tent camps, sealed roads that lead into the tumbleweeds, the small clutch at the roots as the wind takes them. There would have been loneliness and wicked nostalgia. In the mountains where no one will be allowed, there would have been an accumulation of snow like an unending series of predictions. There would have been marketing and PR and product placements, but there would have been no warning. Have a nice day. All right, this next one takes the form of a series of bad jokes, and it's just called jokes, right? It's in numbered sections, but I'm not going to read the numbered sections because I, you know, when you go to a poetry reading and the poet gets like four, and you go, oh God, it's never going to end, right? So I'm not going to do that to you or me, right? So it'll sort of be obvious where the sections are. Jokes. As the joke begins, a doe walks out of the forest, and the trees time-lapse up into the sky, and the ferns unfiddle in the sudden fog. The doe steps out of the forest and shakes her head, blocky and big-eyed. She labors into the numb bracken. The doe steps out of the forest, shakes her head, and says, God. And a pole of light breaks through the fog and pins her to a gap in the trees that she has just made. The doe steps out of the forest, shakes her head, and says, God, I'll never do that again. And the trees behind her apron a litter of bottles. Two guys lost in the woods stumble upon a giant hole in the narrative and stop their discussion about the doe that stepped out of the woods and begin tossing things down into the hole, because that's what a hole demands, after all. The center of the story, the vortex where all things come together and miss. And when they've dropped all that they can find into the hole and no sound echoes up from the bottom to fill the hollowness inside, they set off in search of something heavy enough to fill the hole with noise. And what they find is a railroad tie, and they cart it over and toss it in. Fortunately for them, just then, a goat sprints out of the brush, pumping its origami of legs, and dives into the hole. They stand bent as wet grass, looking down into the hole, hoping to find some answers to all the questions that arise from a silent hole filled with nothing and a goat. Just then, a farmer shambles up and says, in his accent ripe as rotten pears, hey, you boys seen a goat around here? Two guys, two different guys, mind you, the first two are still staring down into a hole in the woods and wondering about the farmer and what, if anything, they should say about the goat that dove into their lives and the hole in it. Two guys walked into a bar. The third one ducked. A duck walks into a bar. Blue head gleaming, plumes the model of sun-worn asphalt, says to the bartender, hey, you seen my brother around here? And the bartender looks at the duck for a minute, then says, well, what he look like? Two guys, a duck, and a goat walk into a bar. Bartender says, what is this, some kind of joke? And so the farmer says, you two boys seen my goat around here? And the two guys say, well, there was this goat just a minute ago, ran up and dove right into this hole. The duck shakes his head, smooths his plumes the color of scravel. The goat says nothing, goes on saying nothing as he falls forever down a hole. In saying nothing, the goat says all that needs to be said about a hole in the woods. And the farmer says, nah, that weren't my goat. My goat's tied up to a railroad tie. The two guys finally find their way out of the woods and into a bar planked with pine and windows full of the small light that struggles through the trees. Two does shoulder through the frames above the bar. They turn their heads expectant in the air, their eyes dead as dice. The two guys are sick of jokes and the hole at the middle of each one, sick of the duck and his vanity, the goat who now kneels down in the corner, content to be doing anything other than falling forever down a hole. Unable to resist, one guy finally says to the other, so this doe walks out of the woods and shakes her head and says, God, I'll never do that again for $2. Nobody laughs. They order a shot and a beer and sit drinking the heart out of a bright spring day. All right, two more poems. One more poem, new one, and then the last thing. This one is a true story about an encounter that happened between Louis Armstrong and Richard Nixon in 1952, if you can imagine those two people coming together. They came together in the airport in California, in LAX. So this is called Ain't Misbehavin'. In the buzzy neon and fresh vinyl of LAX, two men come together, the senator from California and a trumpet player. They come together around the spinning black track the baggage claim makes and grip each other's hand and for a moment look like a photo in its negative. I'm a big fan, says Nixon, smiling rich as cream. If there's ever anything I can do for you, just let me know. And to the surprise of everyone, Armstrong, his eyes shuffled down, says, well, sir, I got an extra bag, and if you could grab it, I'd be grateful. And everyone's watching now, and now Nixon's grin falls a little, but he's a little too good at his job to be rattled, and snatches the bag and carries it through customs, while the merry snickers of the band follow him the way a wake follows a boat into dock. A blue marl of sky clouds the glasses of the men who stand sentry around the senator as the two men move toward the black silk of their limos, and Armstrong opens up his picket fence smile and takes the bag back with a shuck and a nod to all the other layers of the story, race riots and war, the thicket of heat rising up the Manzanita Hills, lies ready to brush fire their way through the American experience. And given all that he was and all that will happen, black-capped burglars with their satchels, wiretaps hissing on the line. I'm only too happy to show you Nixon humiliated here. But who's to say that's the story? The future's still blank as the glasses of the senator's men. A circus of hands gathers the bags and stacks them in the trunks of the cars as the sunlight sloughs off the twin airlines parked nose to nose in the blooming heat. Nixon knew what it meant to make a man a fool. But Armstrong knew customs would never search the senator and find the quarter pound of Jamaican pearl he'd hidden in that bag. All right. So, I'm going to read one last thing. It's a love poem. I know you didn't think I had it in me. This is from my very, very first book called The Halo Brace, and it's a long sequence love poem, and it takes place between a speaker who's alternately an I and a he and a woman who's just known by the letter J. So this is the last section, and I want to thank you guys for coming out. You've been I really enjoyed reading for you. I want to thank Rob again, and you know, for bringing me over, bringing me down here. It's very much a pleasure to read for you. My father gazes on blazing haze, his Iowa prairies running to the horizon. The grass is tall and blonde, and the sun is going down. My mother joins him, the dark tears of her horn rims pinching her face. A squint as if she missed something in the middle distance. It is 1963. The world is changing and they don't even know, though she will grow her hair long and he will wear his collars wide. They are my age and this light is heavy with unfolding, the dark opening across the small yellow house on the cul-de-sac. The day's light is long and auburn. It touches their faces and perhaps I'm speaking to them now. You will have a son and he will love you. And he will come to love beside a woman with rain-dark hair. New days, Jay and I cross fields still golden in the early autumn, watch the wind pass through this grass, leaving patterns no one ever learns. You will be happy while you have each other, and the world will change beneath you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Rob, do we want to do questions, or do you want to just move right into the orgy of book buying that will inevitably follow? Sure, if anybody wants to be. Yeah, of course. That's what it says, doesn't it? Yeah. It's a little bit of poetic license, but I've always been interested in birds. So, yeah. You had a question in the back.
Yeah, I'm curious about that sequence you did, jumping off of
the Celestial Emporium.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did you
That was more of a gift. I mean, I came across this thing, you know, in this essay. Actually, it was a reference to this in another essay. Foucault talks about it in one of his books, and there's a bunch of people who reference this, but I came across it in, I don't even remember where. And so I went to look up the essay, and I found it, and I was just completely enamored with it. This imaginary Chinese encyclopedia. I mean, imagine that's the way you're arguing against somebody. Oh, no, there's this Chinese encyclopedia that I'm making up, right? And so I just had these titles, right? I suddenly had, 12, 13 titles that I had to write poems for. And it was a strange experience because it was different than usually you put the title on sort of as you're going or last. And this one, I sort of, I had to find the poem that made sense with the title. And some of them were easier than others. Like there's one that's just called Others, right? And so that sort of, I could do anything with that one. But some of them, like those that just have broken a flower vase, those that look like flies from a distance, somehow I had to get that conception in there and see what that meant to the poem and make a poem out of that. So oftentimes what you see, I think, what you hear in the poems is me struggling toward a definition or struggling toward that moment when the poem starts to deal with its larger subject. So you have a lot of these sort of long clauses, win, right? These adverbial clauses. And that structure is sort of me thinking the poem toward its goal, which I don't even know what its goal is, but just says something to do with the title and somehow that we gain access to what this means. So the poems came out reasonably quickly, first draft-wise at least, came out reasonably quickly under those terms. But it took me a long time to organize them into a sequence that made sense. It took me a long time to make the poems themselves make sense, to revise and edit and review the poems. So it took me, 3 or 4 years to write that whole sequence. But the first draft of it was a real gift, and it came pretty fast. Like I said, like the camel's hair brush one, I just went to the internet and looked up Google, and I put in camel's hair brush. I had no idea what it was. So then it's not really a camel's hair brush. It's not made of camel's hair, which is what I thought. But it's like a makeup brush, right? It's made with other animals. So that's where that starts, right? But then again, you have to find what the poem means out of that. It's not like my experience necessarily. It's trying to bring my experience to bear on the larger questions that Borges is raising in this example, which seemed to me about sort of the Linnean idea of taxonomy, right? What that means to order, what it means to order things, what it means to order things imaginatively, because his imagination just makes stuff up, right? And it's as valid as anything that, the argument against it. Again, I didn't know all that when I started. Poems for me are very much about investigating ignorance, my ignorance in particular, so that when I came to the that process was an investigative process for me that sort of went to my thinking about what it was that Borges was actually doing. That's thanks for that question though. Yeah.
You think so much with color. Why? Is that something that is conscious in the way that you make poems?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, I'm very invested in poems that are about place and about landscape and about the way that we understand those places and understand the world and see the world. I don't like poems that sort of exist in poem land, that sort of don't, it's just all sort of words happening in somebody's head. That's not that interesting to me. I want to know where I am and how I'm grounded. So I'm always trying to be very concrete in my description and very visual. So I think that's part of it. So there's a couple things happening there. One is that's just my predilection. But two is that it's a conscious effort to be grounding myself and be focused on where I am and what that means. Because the landscapes of that book, particularly Birdwatching in Wartime, but the other poems too, sort of jump around in landscape. I'm a person who's moved around a lot. I don't have a home landscape that I always write about. So my places jump around, and I think that's part of it, that I'm always looking for the value in each particular place. That's another good question. Thank you. All right, well, cheers. Thank you guys very much.